topic number two. I comment often about the covert alliance that exists between the corporate socialists headed by the four Rockefeller brothers in America and the communist bosses of the Soviet Union. It is essential that this relationship be understood, even though the day is fast approaching when the Soviets plan to end it by means of a double cross. But it is also important to grasp the fact that the Rockefellers are not themselves communists. To them, communism is just a very convenient and powerful tool, a stepping stone to power. They don't themselves subscribe to any rigid ideology, communist or otherwise. Their only real doctrine is that of domination and control, along with destruction of everything and anyone they cannot control. In this, they bear a striking resemblance to just one man, Adolf Hitler. What we have today is a blend of emerging fascism, which is a combination of state control with monopolistic capitalism and socialism of the Marxist variety, all wrapped up in American packaging and sold to us by means of Rockefeller public relations propaganda. Our would-be dictators realize full well that if they were to dress up in combat fatigues, get up on a high balcony and rant and rave about the need for the state to control our lives totally, we would all recognize them right away for what they are, and their schemes would fail. Instead, they wear nice business suits, use cleverly worded phrases that seem to say exactly what we want to hear, and make sure that they smile a great deal. And instead of swaying great crowds in a public square from a high balcony, they can now cajole and mislead whole nations from the matchless high balcony of television. In Monthly Audio Letter No. 1, June 1975, I mentioned the role played by the Rockefeller Empire in providing the support Adolf Hitler needed in order to rise to power in Germany. They supported him, watched him, and learned from him. In the late 1920s, the Rockefellers had succeeded in wrestling control of the German dye and drug cartel IG Farben Industry AG away from the British. This, plus an ongoing rivalry between Britain and the Rockefellers over oil, led the British to institute boycott tactics, preventing the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests from exploiting the vast Saudi Arabian oil concessions by which the Rockefellers had pried loose from the British during World War I. The Rockefeller solution? Confront Britain with a threat great enough to break Britain's Saudi Arabian oil boycott. When 22-year-old Nelson Rockefeller returned from his around-the-world honeymoon trip in 1930, he convinced his father, John D. Rockefeller, Jr., that the solution to their problems lay in one Adolf Hitler. Not many Germans really took Hitler seriously in 1930, but the Rockefellers did. Having observed Hitler at close range, they were convinced that Hitler could serve the Rockefeller purpose well. Hitler was obviously bent on conquest and war, so providing the support he needed to achieve power would produce a very real menace to Britain in due course, just the right medicine to cure Britain of her Saudi Arabian boycott against the Rockefeller oil interests. Hitler was especially attractive for Rockefeller purposes for one additional reason beyond his sheer aggressiveness. His earlier failure and imprisonment had taught Hitler a very important lesson, which the Rockefellers themselves had also learned decades before, namely that successful revolutions are best carried out with and not against the full power of a nation's government. In other words, Hitler had concluded that the best way to achieve his goals would be to first acquire control of the government through means which were legal, at least in appearance, and then to carry out the revolutionary changes he desired. Therefore, by supporting Hitler and watching to see how he went about the details of his takeover and revolution, the Rockefellers stood to learn valuable lessons for their own use later on. This was a very nice bonus for the Rockefellers. So support for Hitler through covert channels began immediately, and from 1930 onward, Hitler's star rose rapidly. At the same time, the Rockefellers had to make sure that they would be in a position to check Hitler's advance when he had served his purpose, which was to frighten the British government into surrendering control over Saudi Arabia. In other words, a balance of power had to be maintained so that Hitler would not get out of control. For this reason, and as well as others, Rockefeller's support for Hitler was counterbalanced by support also for the man who, as president, would have the job of getting America into the war to stop Hitler, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. FDR had staged a political comeback from his crippling attack on polio, of polio several years before, but it was about from 1930 onward that FDR's political star rose rapidly on the national scene, paralleling the rise of Hitler in Germany. Throughout their period on the world stage, the careers of Hitler and FDR paralleled one another. Both came to power early in 1933, and both proposed sweeping changes in rapid fashion that differed widely from their campaign pledges. Both exercised unprecedented power during their terms in office, and both died in April 1945, less than 3 weeks apart, as the war in Europe was ending. The dual role of the Rockefellers throughout can be illustrated, for example, by the actions of Nelson Rockefeller. In 1935, he became a director of the Creole Petroleum Company in Venezuela, a subsidiary of Rockefeller-owned Standard Oil of New Jersey. Creole was a principal avenue through which the Nazi war machine was provided with the essential fuel without which war could not have been waged. And for 7 years, 1937 through 1943, Creole Petroleum shipped 90% of its Venezuelan oil production to Germany in Nazi tankers, only a token 10% going to the United States. In this way, the Rockefeller Empire, increasingly dominated by Nelson, David, Lawrence, and John D. III, provided Hitler with over 65 million barrels of oil each year from the Venezuelan oil fields alone, well into the World War II. In 1940, Nelson resigned his directorship of Creole Petroleum to become coordinator of Inter-American Affairs by appointment of Rockefeller puppet president FDR. As coordinator, Nelson was supposedly feverishly at work to combat the Nazi menace in this hemisphere, the very menace that was being sustained by oil provided by his Creole Petroleum Company. Through Hitler, the Rockefellers did at last bring Great Britain to her knees, and a great deal was learned from the plan Hitler followed that is being followed again today by the four Rockefeller brothers. Hitler had two very important rules for exercising power. One was to use the masses by means of effective propaganda, leading them to accept and do things which they normally would not. The other rule was to make sure that any lies were big lies, so big that no one could believe they were lies, coming from their leader. Those same principles are being used today in updated and very smooth ways by the Rockefeller brothers and their agents. Hitler's rise to power was made possible by an era of inflation, shortages, and then depression. The same conditions are being brought about deliberately here in America in order to help achieve the same end result, revolution and dictatorship. While Hitler was in prison, he began writing Mein Kampf, which means My Struggle. In it, and in his speeches, Hitler made it clear what he would do if he ever acquired the power to do it. In a similar vein, we can read The American Rich, published in 1930 by Rockefeller advisor Hoffman Nickerson, The New Federalism by Nelson Rockefeller, The Emerging Constitution, published in 1974 by Rexford Tugwell, quietly revealing a dictatorial new constitution which was written to match a secret outline provided by Nelson Rockefeller himself, or the Bicentennial Declaration advertisements published nationwide in 1975 by John D. Rockefeller III's National Committee for the Bicentennial Era. The last item could have been titled A Bicentennial Manifesto, since a manifesto is nothing more than a public declaration of intentions, motives, or views. But everyone now knows that the Communist Manifesto of a century ago was no joke, so that word was avoided. But keep in mind what Hitler said in January 1941, quote, It is nonsense for the rest of the world to pretend today that I did not reveal this program until 1933 or 1935 or 1937. Instead of listening to foolish chatter, these gentlemen would have been wiser to read what I have written and rewritten thousands of times. No human being has declared or recorded what he wanted more often than I." Unquote. If the four Rockefeller brothers are allowed to succeed in their diabolical plans, they too will be in a position to indict us in practically the same words. Hitler directed much of his appeal to the new generation, young people who had grown up in an abnormal time, lacking normal roots and values, and who were therefore more vulnerable to being misled and used. The introduction of the 18-year-old vote, regardless of its actual effect, was intended for a similar purpose here in America. Hitler pursued a policy of legality, strictly as a tactic, in his campaign to take control of the German government. In every respect, Hitler was challenging the authority of the state under the Weimar Constitution, yet he camouflaged this challenge by using fair-sounding words. The same thing is happening once again here today. The words we hear in the presidential campaign, for example, such as a new world framework for peace, governmental reorganization, interdependence. But the meaning of these words involve world government, surrender of United States sovereignty, and suspension or replacement of the United States Constitution. But why, you may ask, do they bother to leave any clues at all like this if they're trying to be devious? Why don't they just lie outright? The answer is simply that it is harder to lie convincingly than to tell the truth, and if one starts telling actual lies, it becomes harder and harder over a period of time to keep track of what has been said before, and eventually one makes mistakes which can be detected. So instead they tell a little bit of truth, but always in such a way that you won't understand it unless you are very alert. Hitler realized that his policy of legality could only lead to success in one way. That was to gain access to the position of Chancellor and use the emergency powers of the President under the Weimar Constitution. This was true because, try as he might, Hitler was never able to achieve majority popular support for himself or his Nazi Party. And today, our would-be dictator Nelson Rockefeller, who has also been frustrated in his attempts to gain majority popular support nationally, is also trying to position himself to seize control by means of emergency presidential powers. David Rockefeller's agent Jimmy Carter, meanwhile, whose buildup has been used to impress Ford with Rockefeller power, also stands ready in case Nelson's illness should overcome him. In 1936, Hitler said, quote, "It is not enough to overthrow the old state, but that the new state must previously have been built up and be practically ready to one's hand." In 1933, it was no longer a question of overthrowing a state by an act of violence. Meanwhile, the new state had been built up, and all that there remained to do was to destroy the last remnants of the old state, and that took but a few hours." Unquote. So it is that the Rockefeller brothers are rapidly getting the governmental machinery into place, which is to go into full operation under their dictatorial new constitution for the, quote, "new states of America." Unquote. Shortly before Hitler became Chancellor in 1933, he said to then-Chancellor Bruning, quote, "Herr Chancellor, if the German nation once empowers the National Socialist Movement to introduce a constitution other than that which we have today, then you cannot stop it." Unquote. On September 12, 1975, Nelson Rockefeller displayed exactly the same thinking during a news conference in Dallas, Texas. In response to criticisms leveled at him as our appointed vice president by a columnist, Rockefeller's answer was, quote, "Well, he's got one, so there's nothing he can do about it." Unquote. On August 9, 1974, our last elected president, Richard Nixon, became the first in American history to resign, hounded out of office by means of the Watergate scandal. Listen now to the following words taken from a conspirator's diary, and I quote, "For him alone winter seems to have arrived. He is being secretly undermined and is already completely isolated. He is anxiously looking for collaborators. Our mice are busily at work gnawing through the last supports of his position." Unquote. Those words could have been written about Watergate with complete accuracy, but they were not. They were written by Hitler's propaganda chief, Paul Joseph Goebbels, 12 days before Chancellor Bruning was forced to resign on May 30, 1932. Bruning was succeeded by an interim chancellor, more to Hitler's liking, Franz von Papen. And Hitler himself replaced von Papen on January 30, 1933, when Hitler was appointed chancellor by aging President von Hindenburg under the provisions of the Weimar Constitution. It was this weakness of the Weimar Constitution, the fact that the chancellor was appointed, not elected, that enabled Hitler to succeed in his plan to take control of Germany by legal means, despite his lack of majority popular support. This lesson was not lost on Nelson Rockefeller, who introduced exactly the same weakness into the United States Constitution for his own benefit by means of the 25th Amendment. The 25th Amendment was proposed a scant 3 weeks after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy by Nelson Rockefeller's water boy, Birch Bayh, almost as if it had been ready and waiting. Immediately after becoming chancellor, Hitler forced new elections. His election campaign promised nothing at all, but instead simply ran down the failures of the past. Hitler said simply, "Give us 4 years." Meanwhile, he assured his supporters that these would actually be the last elections to be expected for 10, perhaps even 100 years. Terrorism and lawlessness mushroomed during the campaign, culminating in the Reichstag fire just a few days before the elections. This pretext was used to suspend individual liberties as guaranteed by the Weimar Constitution, enabling the Nazis to take any actions they pleased against their political opponents. Following the election and the suppression of all effective opposition, Hitler forced the passage of the infamous Enabling Law, the foundation of Hitler's dictatorship. This gave the Chancellor the right to make laws without the cooperation of the Reichstag for a period of 4 years. Now, after it was too late, it became clear what Hitler had meant in his campaign theme, "Just give us 4 years." Hitler's Enabling Law gave him the power to rule by fiat, which is the power of dictatorship. To enact a law as dictator without the concurrence of the Reichstag, the Chancellor had only to write a law and publish it. And in exactly the same way, the President of the United States can and does make law without any action by Congress in the form of executive orders. These laws, signed by the President himself, become law simply by being published in the Federal Register. Since March 1933, we have been technically in a continuous condition of national emergency, and many governmental powers have been usurped by American presidents under this condition over the past 43 years. But every time a major new phase is entered, there is a fresh declaration of national emergency. In monthly audio letter number 10 4 months ago, I alerted you to the fact that plans are now progressing rapidly toward implementing Executive Order 11490, signed by President Nixon nearly 7 years ago, to provide in detail for a total government takeover of all activities in a declared emergency. And on June 11, 1976, just last month, President Ford signed a new Executive Order 11921 very quietly, which updates the older executive order and shifts the emphasis heavily in the direction of post-attack conditions as we near the outbreak of war. It places heavy emphasis on procedures relating to nuclear, biological, and chemical hazards of the sort introduced into our environment by the planned war. It provides for the establishment, not the preservation, of an economy for the nation. It provides for sweeping controls on that all-important resource, water, which is to be controlled and allocated by the federal government. This is the outcome of the Little Notice National Commission on Water Quality, which was started by Nelson Rockefeller at the same time as his better-known Commission on Critical Choices. My friends, write to your congressman and demand that he send you a copy of the Federal Register for June 15, 1976, and read for yourself the 44 pages of detailed provisions for the national emergency which is planned for all of us. If possible, this will be brought into play in the wake of oil shortages and other disruptions generated in the wake of a Mideast war. But the thrust of Executive Order 11921, just signed by Ford, has to do with the aftermath of nuclear attack. The pattern, my friends, is unmistakable. After Hitler achieved power, he progressively consolidated it by eliminating opposition political parties, ending independent local government, and replacing it with agents of his federal government, enforcing his will by means of his secret police and spies, disposing of troublesome elements by means of concentration camps, and using Germany as a springboard for war to conquer other nations as well. If the Rockefeller brothers succeed in their plans, the United States of America will soon witness a replay of Hitlerism brought up to date and made more repressive and horrible than ever by those who used Hitler for their own purposes. Topic number 3. If nuclear war 1 is permitted to take place as planned on American soil, perhaps you will survive it. Many will not, but some will. But if you do survive, what sort of future do you and your trusting children have to look forward to? My friends, whether or not the Rockefellers are double-crossed by their Soviet allies, the aftermath of nuclear war 1 promises to be slavery for you and all your loved ones. If the Rockefeller brothers somehow find a way to prevent a double-cross by the Soviets, then the war will proceed as planned for the benefit of the Rockefellers. Half of America's population will be consumed in nuclear blasts 1,000 times hotter than the ovens of Hitler. Those who are left will be given the task of rebuilding America along the patterns dictated by the Rockefeller brothers. A once free people, reduced to slave labor, shipped like cattle to one area to rebuild a bombed-out power dam, to another area to work in uranium mines, to still another area to work the agricultural lands owned by the huge agribusinesses owned by the Rockefellers and their collaborators. If the Rockefellers are double-crossed, the death toll during the war itself may be even higher. But the results afterward will be no different. Instead of living under a Rockefeller dictatorship, we will exist under Soviet occupation, whose characteristics will be practically the same. And so, my friends, the choice between the Rockefeller brothers and their Soviet allies is no choice at all. If these things are allowed to come to pass, and the final link in the chain reaction that is to begin with general war in the Middle East, then the life that will be left to us and our little ones will not be worth living. That is why, for my part, I would rather speak the truth now in the hope that we may yet turn to a third choice, the saving of our free country from war and dictatorship while it can still be done. The lesson of history is that this cannot be done, that like countless peoples before us, we will refuse to see the truth, believe it, and act on it in time to save ourselves. That is how most Germans reacted to Adolf Hitler in the early 1930s, and that is how most Americans are still behaving today. But 200 years ago, a small band of very wise men defied the rules of history and created a government that freed men as no government had done in 5,000 years, the United States of America. And you and I can redeem this priceless heritage. We too can and must defy history in the same way by saving the unique heritage that is ours. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.